It's time for Driving Me Crazy, coming to you live from Beechtree Studios near beautiful Pinehurst, North Carolina. This is the only show where a husband and wife drive, talk cars and life, and still love one another each day. Here's John and Laurie. Or is it Laurie and John? Oh, take it away, you crazy kids.
It's just Laurie, has he? Johnny's in Texas.
Oh, you're kidding.
He's in Texas. Well, I'm in Pinehurst, but Johnny's in Texas.
Oh, okay.
So you've got me, and you've got me today. And here I am, and like I said, Johnny sends us his best wishes, but he's on a business trip to Texas.
Right.
But you're gonna have to defuse me, Hezzy, because I'm a little mad about what I'm hearing about General Motors, and I know that you must have heard the same news reports that I have.
Yeah. Absolutely. I was actually petrified when I heard that Ms. Barra made her pronouncement. What was it, just yesterday or the day before?
I think it was a couple of days ago.
Yeah.
It was announced on the 26th of November by Mary Barra,
uh-huh.
the CEO of GM. And now I've mentioned this before, but I was raised with this pronouncement from my grandfather Bogart, buy American or bye-bye America. And the thought that they are going to be cutting their salaried workforce by 15% and their administrative force by 25% and closing 5 factories, of which 3 are in the United States. I don't get it. And I was thrilled.
Well, I do get it. I do get it. There's nothing not to get here. They were bailed out by the United States government, which is the taxpayer. They were just about ready to go belly up years ago. And when they had to make their investment, they didn't invest in America. They invested in China. In fact, the Buick line is made in China. And now they don't even import some of those models, including the models that go to like the Chevy Trax and stuff like that. Because, they say it's going to cost them too much to do it here, and we are not subsidizing their cars. I don't know. So why did they move to China?
Well, and that's the question. And now what's going to happen? I mean, they're going to stop their assembly plant in Ontario, Canada, in Detroit,
yep.
Michigan, where the company is based, born. Trump... all credit to him. He immediately tweeted his displeasure, and GM stock dropped 4%. So now here's the thing that I think concerns me. This concerns me the most. When you look across at what General Motors is producing, all right, they only have – now, I could be all wet on this. But from what I see, they only have 2 electric – their whole premise is they want to, you know, put their money into electric cars. You know,
right.
I'm one of the naysayers, Hezzy. I'm not so sure electric cars – and, you know, I could be and probably am wrong. I don't know that electric cars are the wave of the future. We haven't been out there that much that long to see how the longevity of an electric car is going to be. But right now, GM, General Motors, does the Chevy Volt and the Chevy Bolt. But now I want to tell you what they produce that are gas cars. And okay, yes, I agree. Gas, consumption,
but the
and
Volt,
all that.
They're stopping the Volt. The Volt is going to run out of being subsidized by the federal government for buying a Volt, and they're stopping production. That's
insanity. Then the Bolt will follow.
Assuming that that's where they wanted to invest it, it's only about 6 years old, the whole model. So everybody else is going in and they're leaving. Doesn't make sense to me.
Not to me either. Now, listeners, when you hear General Motors, you probably know it's Chevrolet, Buick, and GMC. But now and Cadillac. Let's bring it down to the raw bone here. You're talking about the Chevy Malibu, the Impala, the Camaro, the Corvette. You're talking about the Equinox, the Traverse, the Chevy Traverse,
yeah,
the Tahoe, the Suburban,
mm-hmm,
the Colorado,
mm-hmm,
the Silverado, all their cargo and passenger vans and their chassis cab trucks. With Buick, you're talking about the Regal, the LaCrosse, which has already been
right,
canned.
Yep.
You're talking about the Encore, the Enclave.
Yep.
You're talking,
mm-hmm,
in GMC about the Canyon, the Sierra, the Acadia, the Yukon, and the entire Denali line, the Terrain Canyon, Acadia,
right,
Sierra, and Yukon. Cadillac, you're talking about the XT4 and 5, the CTS sedan, the STS sedan. Those are going to go down the drain. And plus, remember, General Motors is OnStar. They're AC Delco. This is
right,
the ramifications of what this is going to bring about are unbelievable. What are they thinking?
Yeah, but you know,
are they thinking, Hezzy, that they're going to change the world?
Well, you know, one thing that's interesting is Ford also had thought about leaving, and they reduced their product line. That was over a year ago, if I remember correctly. I'm always bad at remembering things like that. And now General Motors is cutting back and closing down factories. And, you know, maybe Ross Perot was right with the NAFTA treaty and this other treaty. Evidently, it's become less expensive for everybody to move out of the United States. But interestingly enough, just as GM made this announcement a couple of days ago, BMW says, hey, they're thinking of opening up another plant in the United States.
Yeah, in the United States. Exactly.
In the United States.
And
I wonder, so how bad can it be here?
And that's the saying. I mean, the president himself came out with a tweet this morning, and he says, Big Steel is opening and renovating plants all over the country. Auto companies
right,
are pouring into the United States, including BMW, which just announced
correct,
a major new plant. The USA is booming. And so we've got General Motors, one of our founding American brands, pulling this. If I sound angry, it's because I'm actually furious.
Well, you know what's
I mean,
interesting,
you know,
too? It's infuriating to read about it. I don't know if people are keeping up to date, but, you know, the production in China of automobiles and the sales are down tremendously because they're going through their own economic turmoil over there. The real estate model over there is going through the roof, and they're expecting it to implode almost at any time. And China's not doing so well. They're hurting, but we are seemingly hurting as well. So, you know, trade wars are never good. But, you know, the bottom line is what I don't understand is how General Motors believes that they're going to be able to keep and maintain its credibility and its patronage among the American consumer by leaving and closing down three manufacturing plants in America and two in Canada. And Canada in the United States is basically one of the same.
Yeah.
It's just that there's a border there, but big deal. The point is we've got workers there, they've got workers here, and we work in tandem. I don't understand the logic of it, but it must make financial, you know, the bean cutters, or the bean counters, it must make sense to them. But, you know, whatever happened to American pride and America first, and whatever happened to, not that it's, not they make America great again sort of thing, but the point is, why don't we pay attention? Or is government now, you know, I don't know what's the right word, imprisoned by these corporations that can go wherever they feel like. And that's what they do.
And that's exactly so. Now, to the point, we're talking about halting production, stopping production,
mm-hmm,
closing the doors, you know, changing
yep,
the padlock at the GM
yep,
plants in Lordstown, Ohio, in Detroit,
yeah,
in Warren, Michigan, in Marsh,
mm-hmm,
Maryland, and Ontario, Canada, which, of course, as you say, is right on the border. That's almost
right,
15,000 workers plus 25% of their executives. Well, this is insanity.
Correct.
It says, GM says it's part of a global restructuring for the company, moving away from lower-selling sedans to focus on electric and autonomous cars. And I'm going to tell, I've said this before, Hezzy, on this show. I do not believe in autonomous cars. We don't know what that's going to. To me, that is just a massive accident waiting to happen. We even saw in the early days of some of these.
It's going to take time to work out the kinks on autonomous travel in cars and in trucks. But I don't understand.
I think it's going to.
Yeah, go ahead.
I think it's going to take decades. And you know, when we first saw they were trying out some of these autonomous cars, specifically in California, and I think it was it also in Pennsylvania, but maybe I'm wrong there. But the point is, you know, there were crashes. Well, and those were just a few tests. And okay, you got to test things, but I cannot believe that we're going to put our faith 150% vehicle, computerized 100% computerized vehicle, and feel safe that it's not going to make a mistake. There's human error, of course,
you
but
can't
still.
Stop the technology, but we can't berate the technology because it's not ready for consumer use, and so that'll have to be worked out, just like they worked out everything else in time and over time, and the buyer will be very aware that the things could go wrong. I don't know if the insurance is going to be so easy and cheap on those vehicles either, because there are going to be issues and questions. Eventually, though, it probably will get fixed. But that's not the rationale for moving to China.
No.
And they are advancing on electronic technology in China, but so are we. It's not like we're behind the eight ball on this one. We're on the same plane, but I don't know why they. Well, I never understood. Do you think that General Motors and Ford can exist just on their trucks?
Of course not. But before I answer that question, I want to say something. Right now, I wonder how long Mary Barra's employment is going to be at GM, because first of all, she's got the United Auto Workers Union stepping up, and they've challenged her decision. They have said, quote, every legal, contractual, and collective bargaining avenue open to our membership is going to be used to slam this thing. And then Trump himself directed Mary Barra, President Trump directed GM CEO Mary Barra to replace production in the affected factories with other models rather than closing the plant.
Correct.
And he said to her, quote, you better get back in there soon. And that's how I feel. Listen, Mary Barra's response is, we're doing this to stay in front of a fast-changing market. So she's got a crystal ball. Okay, great. But here's the bottom line. You want to know where the problem, in my estimation, lies? And I'm only speaking from somebody, you know, on the streets. But somebody on the streets who's been test-driving cars for over 30 years. Do we really need, Hezzy, all these models, all these variations, having a model car that you can get in five or six variations, and then finding out that 75% of them are not being sold by the end of the model year and are being left at the dealers to get rid of? I mean, remember we used to talk about a Ford sedan? That was back in the 50s. That was a Ford sedan. It was a Ford with four doors. A Ford station wagon.
Yeah.
It was a Ford station wagon. It didn't come in five or six or eight different models. And I'll tell you another, I'm going to tell you a story. I don't mean to be as irate as I am, but I'm venting, but still, I believe I've got a very sound case. Years ago, when I was an international textile designer, I made a presentation to a gentleman named Roger Horchow. He founded the Horchow collection, the mail order catalog company, high-end luxury goods. But in many ways, Roger Horchow invented the mail order catalog business. He was a brilliant man.
Yeah.
And he contacted me. And he said, I want you to come to my offices down here in Dallas and make a presentation. I want you to design a custom bed linens collection. Well, did I get excited. By the time I stepped into his office, I had a portfolio with 200 designs. I had samples of over 100 home furnishings products. This was going to be the bed linens collection to end all bed linens collection. and he had a big office,
right.
And I made my presentation without taking, it was like a half hour presentation. I don't think I took a breath once. I was so over this, excited about it.
Uh-huh.
And when I finished,
yeah.
He sat back in his chair and he looked at me and he said, "I want to tell you a story." He said, "I needed a new tie desperately. And as it happened, the Brooks Brothers catalog came in the mail that morning. I opened it up," he said, "and there were 40 pages of ties. How many do you think I bought?" Well, I immediately said a dozen. And he smiled and he said, "No,
one.
I didn't buy
none.
A single one." And I said, "Why?"
Yeah.
He said, "Because I couldn't make up my mind. I depended upon Brooks Brothers to make the decision for me." Well, General Motors and Ford, American public is looking to you to make a decision for them. You want to come out with a beautiful sedan that's got all the bells and whistles at a good price point and has tremendous mileage, then say to the American public, "Here's your sedan." You want to do the same thing with an SUV or a crossover or a compact, fine, but don't give us 6 and 7 choices. The result is you have flooded and overwhelmed the market, and people can no longer make a choice, not just within your own brand,
I remember,
but because of but all your competitors are offering the same. It's too much. It's overload.
Well, it is. I remember years ago when I was a young guy, and I went into a store, you know, for men's clothing, and there was so much to choose from that I walked out because I couldn't make up my mind either. And that was years ago when they had like boutiques, and I'd gone into one of the boutiques and said, "Oh, this looks like a little bit interesting." And there were only 3 things to choose from, all modern, you know, very much in the now. But the point is I could make up my mind because I had to choose between 1, 2, or 3 or 4 or 5, but that was it. I couldn't go beyond that. That could be very much a male thing, you know, that we just don't have that capacity. But women are better equipped to be able to recognize what it is that they want or need. And so it's just very interesting. But that goes right to what you're saying. And we've gone crazy. We've gone crazy. I don't quite find the same problem with the other manufacturers. I think that like the BMWs of the world, they're not inundated with so many different varieties, or Mercedes-Benz. Even the Japanese and the Korean manufacturers, they don't have that many vehicles, do they? Per line?
Not in this assortment. And remember, the assortment goes beyond 5 and 6 and 8 different semblances of a single model.
Yeah.
Now you've got a car, and it's offered in 10 different colors, and you can have this choice of interiors, and you can have, you know, this standard.
So Ford
Unbelievable.
Was right. Henry Ford was right. Give them basic.
Give them America what they want.
You'll be happy.
Oh, truly. And I mean, do you remember? I remember so clearly when my father and mother bought a Ford station wagon in the early 1960s. And the only question that people said when they said we bought a new Ford station wagon is, "What color?" Because that was the only option.
Uh-huh.
There wasn't like 6 different types of Ford station. It was a Ford station wagon. And if they would...
And you didn't have 5 different engines to choose from, right?
Oh, my gosh, that's right. And you know, is it going to be front-wheel drive, rear-wheel drive, all-wheel drive, four-wheel drive? For goodness sake.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think it's fair to say that the American car industry has a very easy solution. Untie the noose you've tied for yourself and stop hanging yourself. Realize that you have over-flooded Americans with too many choices, too many decisions in an already highly competitive market. Now, you know, GM, for example, is saying, gosh, which is the one? They've got one of their electric, they've got one model car. I wrote it down. I've got to find it. They've got a model car which is being offered in electric, okay? It's like $20,000 more expensive. In the lifetime of that car, am I going to make up savings in $20,000 of difference in price? I don't think so.
No, but that's...
Here it is. It's not $20,000. It's $25,000. It's the Cadillac CT6.
But you know why? You know why they do that? They are doing exactly what happens in the Walmart to the world. They don't pay their workers a living wage, but they tell them that if they work, they'll work out some sort of plan so that the earned income tax credit is afforded them at the end of the year. And so the people who work there at the lowest levels and don't even get a good hourly wage feel that the Walmarts or these other places, that they're actually earning more than they really are, because it's the subsidy that's filling in the place. Remember when the Nissan Leaf came out and it was electric? It came out at $35,000. But there was no reason for that other than the fact that they gave them a $7,500 subsidy for buying one, and therefore it brought it down to the same level as the regular cars. So we were subsidizing that in order for the sale to be made.
And that's exactly what Trump has just told GM. You do this and you've lost your subsidies. Now, back to this CT6.
He's right.
Back to this, it's the Cadillac.
He's right.
Yes, he is absolutely right. And so now watch what the price of the car is. So GM is saying the future's in electric cars. Okay, great. So here's case in point. The Cadillac CT6. You can buy a Cadillac CT6 sedan for $50,000. It's a gas car. Okay, beautiful. Mm. The same chassis, same body hole, in an electric start at $75,000. Who the heck is going to say, wow, I could pay $25,000 more for the same car, and I'm going to see savings of $25,000 over the life of the car in gas? I don't think so. So the whole thing
interesting. People say that they're being ecologically sound by going through to these new technologies such as the electric. And that's all very nice, except they're doing it on other people's money. If they want to do that for the ecology, then fine, no problem. Then pay the $35,000 a year or for the purchase of the car when it's only worth $20,000. But take it out of your own pocket. Don't drive the taxpayer to pay for it. And that's where it's all wrong. And again, this is the same thing. It's our whole model, our whole economic model is the same thing. Guess who invests money in the drug business? It's the government. They get stipends and they get grant money in order to study it. And then guess what? The corporate structure takes it over. Now it's their discovery. We don't get the we don't get the results of that. How come we don't make a buck every time they sell an Excedrin or some other drug? I'm talking about the taxpayer.
And this is absolutely true. And this is exactly what's happening here. But there's other factors too, Hezzy. They have published for quite a long time now that the largest age group getting a new driver's license for the first time are people over the age of 60. Not the 18 to 25-year-olds. People over the age of 60, 65, are applying for the most new driver's licenses, driving to work every day. They occasionally go out to get groceries and do things locally, and maybe if they take a big trip, they hop on a plane. So they're not gas guzzlers.
Yep.
Okay, what about the 18 to 25-year-olds? They're not buying cars. So why are these cars being, devoted to this age group when they're not buying it? They're not even getting driver's licenses. And then you have, all of this. Then bring up the subject of public transportation. Talk about, calling for a taxi Uber. Calling Uber. These all affect an already oversaturated market. Now, as far as this Mary Barra is concerned, I'm sad. Here's a woman who is in one of the most highest profile decision making positions in the world, and I'm speaking as a woman. I would like a woman to show not unproven foresight, but proven courage in addressing what's happening now to her people, to the people that depend upon her decisions for their jobs. And this is where
I don't think corporate America, and it really began with corporate America is is does not think years in advance. They think about the quarterly report and what the finances
right.
will look like. And the bottom line is they don't plan for the nation, and they feel that they're international at this point, and they go wherever they please, and everyone will welcome them, and for a while until they find that they're getting screwed in the process. And America
yes,
has gotten
true.
Really a bad end of the deal here, especially since, what was it, 10 years ago? Or a little bit longer than that, where we bailed out the GM, Chrysler, Ford. No, not Ford.
Uh-huh,
Ford was
uh-huh.
able to do it on their own.
Yeah.
But GM, and,
GM and, Chrysler.
And Chrysler, we saved them, that's for sure.
Well, I want to tell
it's
you.
Insanity.
I want to tell you something that I heard this morning on Sirius 148, the radio classics radio station, my favorite radio station of all
right.
time. Wonderful, wonderful show. And
yeah.
it was a Burns and Allen radio show from the 1940s
oh,
or 50s. They were wonderful. They were wonderful.
Yeah, they were.
And so
yeah.
so Gracie Allen has had a busy day. And when
mm-hmm.
George comes home, he realizes that the lights aren't working. And Gracie says,
yeah.
oh, I canceled the electricity. And so she puts dinner in front of the table, in front of him at the table by candlelight, and it's raw beef. And he said,
yeah.
why didn't you cook it? Well, I canceled the gas. And then she says, I suppose I can't get a cup of coffee. No, I canceled the water. And
oh, wow.
She said, so he said, why did you do these things? And she said, because our grandparents had a much simpler life. And and we can do it too. And I'm thinking, you know, she's not wrong.
Yeah, exactly.
We have complicated our lives so beyond repair,
you know,
practically.
Also, you know what's so interesting as well with the young people not buying automobiles, and a lot of them are getting into bicycling. A lot more people are starting to buy scooters, electric scooters.
Yes, the electric scooters, yes.
And rather than motorcycles. So that's starting for an upswing. And there are just so many other things that are happening, and yet we're not investing in ultra-fast trains so that we can traverse from Washington to New York and Boston, you know, on really just phenomenal services. We're just not making that investment because we've been investing in automobiles, and they're turning out to be our death knell.
And
the young
and,
kids
you know,
just don't want anything to do with it anymore.
It's true. And here's the real bottom line. The home office and the satellite office that are being done from remote, that type of employment, that is the thing people need to focus on. It's happening every day more and more. People are not going into a physical office to work. They're able to work remotely. Heck, I work with a designer in India, for goodness sake. You get phone calls, Hezzy, about some of your services from India, from all over the world. This business about hopping on a train on the Long Island Railroad to get into the city and braving the hustle of Penn Station and then, you know, getting a taxi or bus to work. You're talking about commuting from the island, you're talking about eating up 5-6 hours a day of your life. And that's happening.
Exactly.
And people realize, I can do this from home. I can do it from remote.
Yep.
And this is going to increase.
Absolutely.
And therefore, it's going to absolutely destroy any need to have commuter cars. And that's the thing that's going to happen faster than any electric car, you know, coming on a daily basis or anything of that nature.
Absolutely.
Now, this said, with my last minute for the show, Hezzy, I would have loved to have told you all about the 2018 Golf GT Sports Coupe with manual transmission.
You know, Volkswagen is revamping its product line. I'm very proud of them. They've really been able to pull it out, considering all the problems that they had.
And you well know my mantra, which is, I'm not a real Volkswagen fan, but everybody in my family has one. They've changed my mind over
but
the last several models that I've tested, and this was fabulous. I have.
I thought you were turning a page. Yeah, which...
But with this GTI, I turned a chapter.
Yeah.
This was a stick shift fabulous sports coupe. I loved it. I was shocked. I thought it was fabulous.
Yeah.
I couldn't get enough of it. And I'll talk about it next week. And on that happy note,
okay.
I'm going to go have
all
another cup of coffee.
I can't believe it. This was a really good show because I think we discussed things that are so pertinent in the automotive industry and that
it really gets
touched.
And stay tuned because it's not anywhere near over.
Beginning.
This is just the tip of the iceberg. But in any event,
yeah,
Hezzy, you have a wonderful week. Johnny will be home for next week's show.
Okay.
And Wynn was trying to get on, I have to say. Wynn had trouble as I did at the beginning, of trying to get through. So he meant to be on the show today, but he was unable to call through.
Yeah.
And you'll hear from him next week, provided there's no snowstorm.
All right. Just all the best. Thanks so much.
Bye-bye. Stay safe. Take care.
Be good. Bye. Thank you. Well, there we have it, folks. Lori Wiles pinch hitting for her husband, John Wiles, and, of course, her son, Winston Morrow. So thank God we were able to put it all together. Always an exciting subject that Lori comes up with, so that was very exciting. This is a really major issue, and I think it will impact the nation in great, great deliberation over where to go, what to do, and how to do it. I don't know. I tend to agree with the disgust that the president showed when Mary Barra decided that she was going to reduce that workforce. I just don't know how she thinks she's going to get away with it, but evidently she does. Well, okay, so let's get involved in some other things that now are pertinent. Let's first find out what's going on at the on stage now. It's Phantom at the Westchester Broadway Theater, and then we'll be back. Bear with me a moment.
Now appearing at the Westchester Broadway Theater, it's the triumphant return of the musical thriller Phantom by Tony Award winners Mari Esten and Arthur Coppin. Set to the beautiful and soaring music of Mari Esten, this classic story of romance and intrigue has broken attendance records everywhere. The stage effects are remarkable, as well as the sets and costumes, and our new production will introduce two brilliant new stars, Matthew Billman as Eric the Phantom and Kayleen Seidel as the beautiful ingenue Christine. Critics who have seen this exquisite masterpiece have exclaimed, there may be other musicals out there that tell the story of the Phantom of the Opera, but none as good as this. And before the show, you'll enjoy a served dinner with a choice of six entrees and all for one low price. Order tickets online at BroadwayTheater.com or call 914-592-2222 for the triumphant return of the musical thriller Phantom, now on stage at the Westchester Broadway Theater.
Welcome back. Well, one of the most intriguing things that has just come out is with regard to Michael Cohen. He's pleaded guilty to lying to Congress in a new deal with Mueller in the Trump-Russia probe. So special counsel Robert Mueller has reached a tentative deal with Michael Cohen, the former personal attorney and longtime fixer for President Donald Trump, sources told ABC News. Cohen appeared in federal court in Manhattan today, where he entered a guilty plea for misstatements to Congress in closed-door testimony last year about his contacts with Russians during the presidential campaign. Once among the president's most loyal and zealous defenders in business and politics, Cohen has now promised to put family and country first by cooperating with prosecutors, becoming perhaps the most pivotal public witness against his former boss. Cohen's earlier plea deal with federal prosecutors in the Southern District of New York implicated President Trump in campaign finance felonies. Since then, Cohen has spent more than 70 hours in interviews with Mueller's team. The questioning has focused on contacts with Russians by Trump associates during the campaign, Trump's business ties to Russia, obstruction of justice, and talk of possible pardons. Sources familiar with the discussion have told ABC News. The potential significance of Cohen's cooperation is immense, said Kendall Coffey, a former United States attorney in Florida. As Trump's personal attorney and problem solver for more than a decade, Cohen's portfolio at the Trump Organization covered personal and business matters, both routine and highly sensitive. His dealings while serving as a senior executive in Trump's global empire include several projects thought to be of interest to Mueller's prosecutors, most notably the pursuit of a Trump Tower project in Moscow during the presidential campaign. It cannot be determined if Cohen's cooperation will lead to other criminal allegations, Coffey said, but for most high-powered business people with complex business interests, having one's personal attorney become a star witness for the prosecution is the worst possible legal night. Cohen once said that he would take a bullet for the president, but has now come to regard Trump as dangerously unfit for the presidency, according to people close to Cohen. He has been determined to tell Mueller's team, other federal prosecutors, and the New York State Attorney General's office all that he knows, and his testimony poses a potentially serious threat to the president, sources told ABC News. They also say that Cohen's voluntary cooperation has been crucial to the special counsel's case. The news of the agreement comes during a tumultuous week in the Mueller investigation. On Monday, the special counsel's plea deal with Trump's former campaign manager Paul Manafort officially collapsed, with prosecutors alleging that Manafort breached the contract, or the pact as they call it, by lying to federal agents and government lawyers during interviews. Manafort's attorneys dispute the allegations that he lied. The president this week has been ratcheting up his criticisms of the investigation and Mueller's team, accusing the prosecutors in a Wednesday tweet of viciously telling witnesses to lie about facts and likened the inquiry to the dark period in American history when Republican U.S. Senator Joseph McCarthy sought to expose alleged communist sympathizers in the 1950s. Now, sources familiar with the special counsel's proposed agreement with Cohen told ABC News that a 52-year-old New Yorker will admit to make multiple misstatements to two congressional intelligence committees investigating alleged collusion between the Trump campaign and Russia to influence the 2016 presidential election. It was not immediately clear what Cohen told the congressional committees in the fall of 2017 that he will now say was false. Though much remains unknown about the scope of the investigation, Mueller is reportedly at work on preparing his final report, and Washington is bracing for the potential of another round of indictments now that the midterm elections have passed. Cohen's anticipated agreement with Mueller also comes just 2 weeks before he is due to be sentenced in a separate case in federal court in New York, which burst into public view in April when federal agents raided his law firm and residences. Cohen pleaded guilty in August to 6 felonies associated with his personal business dealings, including tax evasion and making false statements to a bank, and 2 felony campaign finance violations in connection with his role in arranging non-disclosure agreements during the campaign with 2 women who had claimed past affairs with Trump. During a plea hearing in that case, Cohen directly implicated President Trump in the alleged schemes to silence the women, adult film star Stormy Daniels and former Playboy model Karen McDougal. Cohen told the court that he made the arrangements for those hush money deals in coordination with and at the direction of a candidate for federal office, referring to then-candidate Trump, for the principal purpose of influencing the election. Trump has denied the allegations of the affairs and has said that he learned of the deals only after they were made. The president's attorney, former New York City Mayor Rudy Giuliani, who once called Cohen an honest, honorable lawyer, said after the plea hearing that Cohen's actions, quote, reflect a pattern of lies and dishonesty over a significant period of time, end quote. Cohen remains free on bond in advance of a sentencing hearing scheduled for December 12. He is facing a possible term of 46 to 63 months in prison and a potential fine of up to $1 million. Cohen's voluntary cooperation with Mueller could earn him significant credit with a special counsel in advance of his sentencing date in the New York case. If Cohen cooperates and provide substantial assistance, still receive a recommendation from the government for a reduced sentence, even though it was not part of the original plea agreement, said Barbara McQuaid, a University of Michigan law professor and a former federal prosecutor. Since entering his guilty pleas in Manhattan, Cohen has been talking with multiple agencies investigating the president. He is doing so voluntarily without the protection of a formal cooperation agreement or the specific promise of a reduced sentence. His cooperation has already created the most serious federal allegations to date concerning President Trump, and more may be coming, Coffey said. Cohen's interviews with Mueller's team have also been attended in part by federal prosecutors in the Southern District Court of New York and by lawyers from the Office of New York State Attorney General who are investigating the Trump family's charitable organization. Cohen is potentially a very significant cooperator in light of his close relationship with Trump, McQuaid said. And Cohen has confirmed he attended a lunch meeting with a Ukrainian politician 1 week after Trump took office, where the two men discussed the potential for Cohen to share with his contacts at the White House a Ukraine peace proposal reportedly favored by Russia. Cohen also played an integral role in discussions about a possible Trump Tower in Moscow. Negotiations were going on at least through the early stages of the 2016 presidential campaign. Cohen's credibility could be subject to significant cross-examination because of his long history of defending Trump. But if Mueller can corroborate Cohen's testimony with documents, recordings, or other witness testimonies, then it could be very valuable, McQuaid said. Cohen's expected admission to making misstatements to Congress and his cooperation with investigators coincide with his very public transition over the past several months from the staunch Trump loyalist who protected the president and his family to a possible key witness against the president on multiple fronts. Cohen clearly signaled his intention to abandon his long-standing fealty to Trump, telling ABC News in a June interview that my wife, my daughter, and my son have my first loyalty and always will. I put family and country first, he said. His guilty plea, set to be entered on Thursday, centers around his testimony to Congress in the fall of 2017 at a time when Cohen was still firmly in the president's camp, sources said. In a public statement released in September 2017 in advance of his closed sessions on Capitol Hill, Cohen said that he had, quote, nothing to do with any Russian involvement in our electoral process, he said. He never saw anything, not a hint of anything, that demonstrated President Trump's involvement in Russian interference in our election or any form of Russian collusion. He said that the raw intelligence reports that made up the now infamous Steele dossier, which asserted that Cohen had a key role in a secretive Trump campaign connection with Kremlin operatives, were, quote, riddled with total falsehoods and intentionally salacious allegations, end quote. Cohen also claimed in the statement that the proposal he worked on during the campaign to build a Trump property in Moscow was, quote, solely a real estate deal and nothing more. End quote. The plan was terminated in January of 2016, Cohen said, after it was determined that the project was not viable for business reasons. Under federal law, it is a crime to knowingly and willingly make materially false statements to Congress or to any branch of the federal government in connection with matters under investigation. Violators can be punished with a fine and up to 5 years in prison. So that is the latest update on what's going on. This is going to be a mind blower. Unbelievable. Literally unbelievable. Wow. Okay. Well, we're going to have to see where this is going to go. But it doesn't look good for the president, that is for sure. I don't know where this is going to lead. Michael Edelman, the national analyst that is on our program every Monday morning from 10:30 to 11, has been saying this for a very long time. And it's just truly unbelievable. He foretold all of this. The president is going down. I don't know what he's going to do, but he's furious. That's for sure. And this is interesting. Already it's begun, has threatened to declassify devastating documents about Democrats. Well, in a wide-ranging exclusive interview with the Post, President Trump said Wednesday that House Democrats launched probes into his administration, which he called presidential harassment. They'd pay a heavy price. If they go down the presidential harassment track, if they want to go and harass the president and the administration, I think that would be the best thing that would happen to me. I'm a counterpuncher, and I will hit them so hard they'll never been hit like that before, he said during a 36-minute Oval Office sit-down. The commander-in-chief said he could declassify FISA warrant applications and other documents from Robert Mueller's probe, and predicted the disclosure would expose the FBI, the Justice Department, and the Clinton campaign as being in cahoots to set him up. I think they would help. I think that would help my campaign. If they want to play tough, I will do it. They will see how devastating those pages are. But Trump told the Washington Post he wanted to save the documents until they were needed. It's much more powerful if I do it then, Trump said, because if we had done it already, it would already be yesterday's news. Mm-hmm. Trump revealed his playbook just as Democrats are set to take over House committees in January, where they are poised to investigate his potential business conflicts of interests, tax returns, Russia dealings, and more. With the GOP losing power in January, its congressional investigations all into alleged Department of Justice misconduct in launching the Russia probe is expected to fizzle out. In September, a group of Trump allies in the House, led by Representative Lee Zeldin of New York, called on Trump scores of Justice Department documents they believe undercut the start of the Russian investigation and show bias against Trump. So the documents include justice officials' requests to surveil Trump campaign advisor Carter Page and memos on the Department of Justice official Bruce Orr's interactions with Christopher Steele, the author of a controversial dossier that alleged Trump ties with Russia. And Trump initially agreed to declassify the documents, including text messages sent by former FBI officials James Comey, Andrew McCabe, as well as Peter Strzok, Lisa Page, and Orr. And the Trump allies believe the revelations will show favoritism toward Hillary Clinton in a plot to take down Trump. Trump then reversed course, citing the need for further review and concern of U.S. allies. Trump added Wednesday that his lawyer, Emmett Flood, thought it would be better politically to wait. He didn't want to do it yet because I can save it, Trump said. The president also pushed back on the notion that all the Justice Department documents should eventually be released for the sake of transparency. Bear with me a moment. So some things maybe the public shouldn't see because they are so bad, Trump said, making clear it wasn't damaging to him but to others. Maybe it's better that the public not see what's going on with this country. Oh, my God. So this could be an awakening. Unbelievable. This will be one hell of an awakening, that's for sure. All right. Let's quickly go back to our studio screen. Find out what's going on in our neck of the woods. And, okay, and then we'll be right back. Let's find out what they're doing at the Yonkers Tribune.
The Yonkers Tribune, named Home of the Acid-Tongued Bloggers by the New York Times, is a multifaceted news organization dedicated to keeping the citizens of Yonkers and Westchester informed via the internet and radio. Hezzy Aris is the tireless publisher, editor, and radio host of the Yonkers Tribune. He is a balding, bearded gnome, equipped with a digital camera and a steno pad at all times. Hezzy is frequently spotted in local meetings, translating the events into a Baroque prose style with an infusion of well-mannered outrage. The Yonkers Tribune attracts an informed, well-educated, affluent audience who hungers to know more about politics in all its permutations and nuances. Politics, says Hezzy, is our forte. Advertising inquiries are always welcome. Please call Hezzy Aris at 914-562-0834 or send an email to ehezi@hush.com.
Welcome back. This is Westchester on Level. My name is Hezzy Aris. Another number to reach out to the Yonkers Tribune, should you care to advertise for them, is simply to call 347-415-4326. 347-415-4326. So 347-415-4326. That's the number to call. Well, let's find out what else is going on in around the world and also related, of course, to the United States. Argentina has launched a security operation for, you know, just with respect to the G20 meeting in Argentina. Listen in.
City of some 3 million people on near lockdown. As world leaders descend on Buenos Aires for the G20, security in the capital is tight. 22,000 Argentine agents are watching the streets, along with 2,000 security forces from foreign delegations. In an attempt to ensure the city remains calm for the two-day summit, Friday has been declared a national holiday. A move that for some has been hard to swallow because it means economic losses.
It's a mess. It means I won't be able to work because they made it a mandatory holiday, which I don't agree with. Nobody agrees with it.
This is the first major summit in Argentina in 13 years. For the government, it's an honor, one that could help the country emerge from a crippling recession. For others who came out in protest this week, it will not help Argentina.
Our main goal is to say no to the G20. President Macri is here to negotiate the people's hunger, give away all of Argentina's remaining natural resources, and keep sinking us further into poverty.
To keep protests from turning violent, as they have at previous G20 summits, security forces have closed off entire areas of the city. But Argentina is going through its worst economic crisis in nearly two decades, and thousands are expected to continue to voice their struggle in the streets on Friday for the kickoff of the two-day event.
Let's move on to something else that has to do with us here in the United States. Bear with me a moment. This is with regard to the U.S. Senate defying President Trump and voting to cut support to Saudi forces in Yemen.
The yeas are 63, the nays are 37. The motion is agreed to.
With a nearly two-thirds majority, the U.S. Senate votes to advance a resolution ending the country's support for Saudi Arabia's war in Yemen, a bipartisan rebuke for both Riyadh and the White House.
U.S. intervention in Yemen is unauthorized, unconstitutional, and immoral. The issue of war making, of going to war, putting our young men and women's lives at stake, is something determined by the U.S. Congress, not the President of the United States.
U.S. support for the Saudi coalition in Yemen includes intelligence sharing and training Saudi pilots. Top Trump administration officials had fought to persuade lawmakers that a regional counterbalance to old adversary Iran was more important than Riyadh's alleged murder of a Saudi journalist in Istanbul last month, or the millions of Yemenis currently on the brink of starvation after 4 years of war. Talks between the Saudi-backed government and the rebel Houthis are set for early December in Sweden.
I think we are close to create the conditions for the possibility for peace talks to start, and that would be an extremely important objective.
Just ahead of the U.S. Senate vote, Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman arrived for the G20 summit in Buenos Aires, where Argentinian prosecutors are considering a request from Human Rights Watch to press charges against the Crown Prince for alleged war crimes.
My goodness, so much is happening around the world, that's for sure. And this is really quite fascinating. This is with regard to what's going on in the Russia-Ukraine tensions. So listen, and this is really unbelievable. In a moment, we'll get started in a second. Okay, we're going to get that done in a moment. Bear with me.
Rob, is there any substance to Vladimir Putin's claims that this was a provocation on the part of the Ukrainians planned all along?
Well, you know, it's not without credibility, but I think it's probably exaggerated. You know, it may be the case that the Ukrainians recognize that it would be provocative to send those three ships to pass through the Strait of Kerch into the Sea of Azov. They may, we don't know for sure, have not notified the Russians sufficiently in advance. They may even maneuvered provocatively, although the Ukrainians say they didn't. But I think, you know, the idea that the Ukrainians would have anticipated the aggressiveness of the Russian response and then use that to create this international instance and this domestic crisis, I think is stretching things way too far. I think the Ukrainians were as shocked as anybody by the aggression of the Russians and the subsequent arrest of the 24 sailors, and then that sort of show performance when three of them were brought out on television, the sort of scene we usually have come to expect from terrorist organizations, not from a veto-carrying member, permanent member of the United Nations Security Council. So, yes, there was provocation probably from the Ukrainian side, but the idea that President Poroshenko was some sort of Machiavellian maestro who calculated the Russians will act with so much aggression that we can then demand to introduce martial law inside Ukraine, I think is absurd.
So we're talking here about this very narrow Kerch Strait. What does international law say about these waters and who can legally go through them?
Well, there are a number of things. First of all, the agreement between Russia and Ukraine of 2003, which states that these are territorial waters shared by both. And then in addition to that, there's the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea. And what it says is that all ships, including foreign warships, enjoy the right of innocent passage within another state's territorial waters, so long as the passage is innocent. Now, what is innocent? Now, according to the same convention on the law of the sea, it is innocent so long as it is not prejudicial to the peace, good order, or security of the coastal state. So if this were to go to international arbitration, and there's every possibility it will find a solution to the situation, the Russians would have to demonstrate that there had been a threat or use of force, exercise or practice of weapons, or any other act of propaganda which would affect the security of the state, in other words, Russia. I think it will find it is very difficult for Russia to do that. So the Russians will be very reluctant to put this international arbitration, but the Ukrainians will probably seek to do that and milk international sympathy.
So how do we see this playing out, Rob? We've got now martial law in Ukraine, these Ukrainian prisoners being paraded on Russian television, talk of sanctions. Where do we think this is going?
Well, it certainly doesn't look good. At a time when people have been hoping that relations between Russia and the Western world might start to improve, that there might be the possibility of lightening the sanctions load on Russia, this pushes things in exactly the opposite direction. I don't think this means that there's any danger of war between Ukraine and Russia. Ukraine is not so foolish as to provoke Russia to go that far. It would be devastating for the Ukrainians. They would clearly lose in an armed conflict, and certainly there will be immense pressure on Ukraine from the Western world and from NATO not to be sucked into a conflict like that. They also remember what happened to Georgia in 2008 when it was sucked into a conflict with Russia and lost heavily. But obviously, this does not make things good. You know, that you refer to the parading of the prisoners on television. It's an ugly spectacle, which again points to Russia's constant failure to develop soft power in international relations. It resorts still to the use of these bully boy tactics, which assert Russia's presence on the world, remind the rest of the world that Russia is a power to be dealt with, but does not really project an image that the rest of the world finds attractive. So I think that relations will sour. Any prospect of an improvement in relations in the West and Russia will be put off by months at least, possibly by even longer.
Thank you for that, Ron. That's our Chief Foreign Editor, Robert Parsons.
All right, well, let's find out. Russia and Ukraine tensions continue, and Kiev has asked NATO to send ships to the Sea of Azov. Listen to this. Wait a second. Bear with me a moment as we get this going. One second here. All right. Okay, let's see where we go.
We won't let them enter Ukraine. That's the message Petro Poroshenko repeated to his troops. During a training center, the Ukrainian president said his nation was getting ready for the possibility of full-fledged war with Russia.
We will not give them a chance to enter Ukraine. Now we must improve our skills. We must organize an effective preparation so that, if necessary, we can inflict a defeat on the enemy.
The move comes after Russian ships along the Kerch Strait fired on three Ukrainian boats on Sunday. Russian forces then seized the vessels and are now detaining the soldiers who were aboard. Poroshenko also made a plea to NATO on the German paper Bild, requesting the support of NATO ships. He said Europe should not believe Moscow's lies, and that Vladimir Putin, after annexing Crimea in 2014, now wants to control the Sea of Azov and all of Ukraine. The choice of directing his plea to German media is not without its reasons, for Germany is the largest buyer of Russian gas. Berlin called for an easing of tensions, saying that Washington's talk of new sanctions against Russia was premature. Meanwhile, Vladimir Putin laid blame on Poroshenko, saying he was trying to raise his approval rating.
It's clearly a provocation. A provocation organized by the Ukrainian authorities, and I think by the president himself. Ahead of the presidential election, scheduled to happen in March of next year.
At the president's request, martial law has been rolled out in 10 border regions in Ukraine. The month-long measure allows the government to mobilize citizens and to increase border controls.
All right. My goodness, there's so much going on around the world. It's hard to keep up with all of this. So let's just see what else is happening here. And on the world stage, I just want to make sure that we have all in place. Let me move over to this because I always find this interesting. Poland's glittering Christmas creche win the UNESCO status. Out of Krakow, we hear that nativity scenes that are a centuries-old Christmas tradition in Poland's historic royal capital of Krakow were granted UNESCO special status today, being added to its register of intangible cultural heritage of humanity. For generations, competitions for the best nativity scenes have drawn artists to the southern Polish city. This is a special moment for everyone whose heart is set for caring for Polish heritage. Culture Minister Pietro Gliński tweeted after UNESCO announced the granting of the special status. The Christmas cribs are made entirely by hand, ranging from a glittering rainbow of colored aluminum foil to wood, cardboard, lace, and in a sign of the times, eco-friendly materials like beans, dried orange slices, and bay leaves, as well as digital animations. The scenes, which come in all shapes and sizes, are intricately detailed feats of small-scale engineering, often capturing the hallmarks of Krakow's architecture and folklore, including an historic church bell tower, the Wawel, a royal castle, and ancient city walls, mythical dragons and horsemen. Nativity scenes and cribs or creches, as they are also known, can measure up to 2 meters, or that's about 6.5 feet in height, or be tiny miniatures. Each year, the displays draw legions of visitors, including tourists from far afield. Roman Catholic Order of Franciscan Friars imported the tradition to Poland in the 13th century. Over time, Poles have made it their own by including national heroes like the late Polish-born Pope John Paul II or Nobel-winning physicist and chemist Marie Curie in the scenes alongside angels, the baby Jesus, the Virgin Mary, Joseph, and the three kings. Current affairs are also woven into the Christmas tradition, as is Poland's often painful history. In the past years, some creches have evoked the communist regime's brutal 1981 martial law crackdown on the freedom fighting Solidarity trade union. Symbols of Polish patriotism, including a white eagle and the red and white flag, feature prominently in some of the creches. The nativity scenes hail from as far away as the United States, and Polish Americans sending their entries to the competition as a way to keep up tradition. And in the digital age, this much loved custom is also entering cyberspace with the competition's organizer, the Krakow Historical Museum, also holding a contest for the best digitally animated cyber creche. Very, very exciting. So, Christmas is definitely on the way. So evidently in Krakow, they are ready. And what an exciting, exciting theme that is for sure. Okay. Well, Dad was born in Poland, so how could you not love it, right? Let me just look and see what else is happening here on the I think we've covered all that we can here in the Americas. And let me just quickly see what else there is over here. Bear with me a moment. Yes, we needed to cover this. So evidently the ex-French diplomat is set for a victory in the Georgia presidential vote. So let's just hear the report on this. Bear with me a moment. Okay, so we're going to find out in a moment here. Okay.
Salome Zurabishvili is on course to victory to secure the Georgian presidency. A closely contested second round of voting held under the watchful eye of international election monitors. A candidate of the ruling Georgian Dream Party, Zurabishvili favors cooperation with both Russia and the West.
We have finally and firmly rejected our past today. A past which would most of all impede a stronger society from moving forward. Our choice is a peaceful Georgia, a free country where citizens have equal rights. Our choice is a dialogue with those who did not vote for me today. Her challenger, United Opposition candidate Grigol Beshadze, leans towards a more pro-Western approach. In the first round of the ballot held last month, he fell short of bringing in enough votes to secure an absolute majority required for the presidency. He has criticized the legitimacy of Wednesday's vote and the allegations of irregularities during the ballot.
Whatever the final results of the vote will be, we have reached our main goals. The United Opposition is created, we will stay together, and everything begins from here.
While the new head of state will be largely a ceremonial role, the election is Georgia's last direct presidential contest as it transitions to a parliamentary system of government in 2020.
Wow. So that's where things are going. One second. One moment here. Quickly go over to see if anything's happening in Europe that we haven't covered. And I don't think so. I think we're up to date with that. Okay, and then we should go over to the Middle East and see if anything is happening there. We actually covered so much of this yesterday. All righty. And let me just quickly see if anything else is happening elsewhere. Yeah, we should cover this again, even though we spoke about it with Lori Wiles. But the bottom line is here: the numbers. General Motors announced Monday will cut 15% of its workforce, shutter 5 factories in North America to save $6 billion and adapt to changing market conditions, which we, I think we did cover, but that's what I had on my report. So we'll just move beyond that. And let me just see. Oh, this is really quite important because I don't know if it's getting much attention. Evidently, the Indonesians say that Lion Air, the jet that was used in the flight, was not airworthy on the flight before it crashed. So Indonesian investigators said Wednesday that a Lion Air Boeing 737 jet that plunged into the sea, killing 189 people on board, was not airworthy on a flight the day before it crashed, which was on October 29. The October 28 flight from Bali to Jakarta had experienced similar technical issues to the doomed flight the next day from Jakarta to Pangkai Pinang, said Nurcayo Utomo, head of Indonesia's National Transport Safety Committee, the KNKT. The pilot of the October 28 flight chose to press on to Jakarta after shutting down the plane's anti-stall system, Utomo had said. This is the basis of our recommendation to Lion Air. In our view, the plane was not airworthy, he told a news conference in Jakarta. During the early morning flight, one of the pilots asked flight controllers to confirm the altitude and speed of the aircraft. The pilot then reported that they were experiencing a flight control problem, quote-unquote, KNKT announced in a statement earlier on Wednesday. Last Homo told Parliament that the jet's maneuvering characteristics augmentation system, MCAS, an automated modification new to the model that crashed, activated and directed the plane's nose down to prevent a stall. The jet system had detected it was in a stall due to a faulty indicator and gave the captain a warning through a stick shaker that vibrated the controls, he said. Pilots flying the same plane a day earlier had experienced a similar problem until they used switches to shut off the system, KNKT said in a statement. So the agency recommended that Lion Air improve its safety culture to ensure that a pilot can make proper decisions to continue a flight. The investigation all into the crash is in its early stages and is hampered by the lack of evidence from the cockpit voice recorder, which remains lost on the seabed. KNKT has not yet said what caused the crash, and the recommendations are an indication of areas of conflict and focus, but not necessarily the ultimate cause. On Wednesday, KNKT acknowledged actions to improve safety had been taken by Boeing, Lion Air, the U.S. Federal Aviation Industry, the FAA, and Indonesia's Directorate General of Civil Aviation. So at Indonesia's request, Boeing issued an advisory about MCAS to airlines earlier this month that was quickly followed by a U.S. Federal Aviation Administration directive making that mandatory. So, my goodness, there's a lot going on, right, all around the world. And okay, let's just quickly see what else is happening. I think that's where we are. Let's take a quick break and find out what's going on in our neck of the woods. Let's find out what they're doing at the Cabot Creamery, and then we'll be back.
Hey, you a judge?
Sorta. I report on cheese. I don't judge.
Well, I heard on the radio Cabot Cheddar always wins awards for taste.
Well, let me see my notes. Best taste? Check. Best texture? Check. The farm families in Cabot, Vermont have won every major award in the cheese world.
Every award?
Every.
What about the U.S. Cheese Championships?
Cabot's won that many times.
How about the American Cheese Society Contest?
Cabot won it.
World Cheese Championship Award?
Best in class on cheddar.
Fiery Food Challenge?
Cabot.
International Fancy Food Show?
Cabot rules.
The Stanley Cup?
That's hockey.
Oh.
Look, Cabot's won awards for best sharp, best light, best butter, and best cheddar.
Yeah, but a certain big cheese company's TV ad show, they won an award from judges wearing bright yellow lab coats.
Oh, those are actors.
Not real judges?
Real judges wear white lab coats.
They do.
Look, Cabot is best because they own the company, ship the milk, make the cheese. They won so many times, the real judges even asked one of Cabot's cheesemakers to be a judge.
I don't believe you.
Here, taste.
Hey, I can taste why Cabot's won every award.
You be the judge.
And I get to wear a yellow lab coat.
White lab coat. Check.
The best tasting cheddar on the planet is...
Time and time again.
Cabot Cheddar.
Check.
Oh, welcome back. Evidently, the U.S. economy is starting to recognize storm clouds on the horizon. So, emerging signs of weakness in major economic sectors, including auto manufacturing, agriculture, and home building, are prompting some forecasters to warn that one of the longest periods of economic growth in U.S. history may be approaching the end of its run. The economy has been a picture of health, expanding at a 3.5% annual pace during the third quarter and driving the unemployment rate to 3.7%, the lowest level in almost half a century. But General Motors plans to cut 14,000 to 15,000 jobs and shutter 5 factories. Reinforces other recent indications that the better part of the expansion is now in the rearview mirror. We're in the 10th year of expansion, and there are some soft spots, said Ellen Hughes Cromwick, a former chief economist at Ford Motor Company and the Commerce Department, who is now on the faculty at the University of Michigan. The auto sales cycle has peaked, and the housing cycle has also peaked. So the vast majority of prominent economic forecasters, including various arms of the federal government and all of the major Wall Street banks, regard continued growth as the most likely outcome for the U.S. economy in 2019. But there is a broad consensus that the pace of growth will slow as the sugar high provided by the Trump administration's $1.5 trillion tax cut and spending increases begins to wear off, and some forecasters see a small but growing chance of a recession. President Trump's chief economic advisor, Larry Kudlow, tried to play down such concerns on Tuesday, and we'll see where that goes. So, that is the issue there. Now, let's quickly go over and check one more thing. One second. We'll just see if there's more here to... let me see if there's just more here to look at. All right, one second. All right. Okay. I was looking to see if there were any other news outlets that we could look at to see how to catch up with some more news, if there was any. I think we're really caught up, if you must know. So, I think, oh my goodness. Evidently, Sean Patrick Maloney, we spoke to you about him yesterday. He's recovering. Evidently, he's dropped out of the Democratic Campaign Committee race. In a letter obtained, Maloney thanked Pelosi for her consideration of his candidacy and pointed to his recent hospitalization over a bacterial infection as the reason behind ending his campaign. So, he says, oh, well, I appreciate your consideration. Given my temporary hospitalization, I've decided that at this time it would be best for me to pursue other ways to contribute to the 116th Congress. He added, I believe it is in the greater interest of our caucus to decide the remaining leadership position or positions without undue delay, so we can be at full strength for the battles to come. Okay, so that's the story there. I'm going to quickly go back to our, to our email server. Looks like we're fine over here. And bear with me a moment. Okay, I think we're good. Well, that's the end of our time with you today. So I want to thank you for being with us. And we hope to speak to you tomorrow. All the best. Goodbye.